thank you. It's a pleasure to be among friends once again. So my topic, Drivino Soul Travel, is part of a broader project which I have undertaken together with our colleague friend Kevin and with Bro and Neil. It was an investigation of the way the early Christian Alexandrians and Egyptians would look at dreaming, visions, and so on, related phenomena, the nocturnal space, if you like. And as it happens, Kevin and I have big news. Cambridge University Press just accepted our book. But as it happens, part of the initial project could not be included in the book. They did not like Athanasius or Athanasius. It was too much for some reviewers or whatever. The decision was made to kindly invite me to take this bit out, which actually is a pity from my viewpoint, because I believe that this bit was the actual contribution that I had to make. But, well, that's how things go. We're happy that the book will be published in the fullness of time, knowing how these big publishers work. It'll take a while, maybe a decade or so. all good things. Just briefly to walk you through what I want to say. I have a challenge to throw in the midst. I'll introduce briefly my approach, then present the textual evidence, and I'll undertake a brief assessment of my findings. So, looking at the challenge, what's my challenge? First of all, a bit about the text. Against the Gentiles is a treatise which all the scholarship has ascribed to the early years of Saint Athanasius, even before his becoming a bishop. But as more recent scholarship has proven, particularly Camlot, one of the editors of his works in modern times, that was in the 70s, but then, in the 40s, but then in the 70s and 80s, Mehring returned to the topic and has proven that the authority of the author that addresses the readership via Against the Gentiles is not that of a youngster, according to the previously established narrative. Athanasius must have been like 18 or 17 when he wrote that amazing book, and that's impossible. I mean, or maybe genius or something, but it's not just the intelligence and the knowledgeability of the author of Against the Gentiles. It's about the tone, and the tone of this book proves that it's written by a mature person, someone in authority, someone that speaks with authority. So, we don't know yet when this book was actually produced. The current view is that of Khaled Anatolios, was a foremost Athanasian scholar in our time, and he believes that Against the Gentiles must have been written some time around the first exile of Saint Athanasius, possibly from Rome, anyway, not from Alexandria or anywhere else in Egypt. So it's a work written whilst he was in exile. There's another interesting thing about this book. Most patristic scholars include this work among the apologies, Alexandrian apologies. The early Christians were very strong in contextualizing the gospel against the backdrop of the culture of that time. So they had produced this genre called apologetic genre, which was supposed to, on the one hand, defend Christianity against malevolent attacks and biased accusations, on the other hand, to explain what Christianity was all about. From a certain viewpoint, against the Gentiles satisfies the criteria of the genre, but not entirely. And more recently, marrying in the 80s, and more recently John Baer, after him in the early 2000s, they both have iterated the view that against the Gentiles is actually a catechism, a bit of a strange catechism, but nevertheless something that did not have to do with the pagans, the Gentiles. It was more a work oriented to the unconvinced among the educated Christians of that age. In other words, it is an apology because it undertakes to highlight the superiority of the gospel to any other form of philosophy. That's actually the idea. But it's not addressed to pagan philosophers. It's actually addressed to the Christian intelligentsia, perhaps from Athanasius' own see of Alexandria, where there was a lot of competition with pagan schools of philosophy and so on and so forth. I'm of the opinion that it's indeed a catechetical apology. Something like that. So it is indeed part of a pastoral strategy to bring back into the fold the educated Christians that were fascinated by the brilliance of the classical culture. The book is usually sectioned, if you like, separated in three parts. The largest one, the first one, is an overall attack on paganism as religion and morality. The second one, which is of interest here, very short, deals with how God can be accessed by walking on the path of the soul. And the third one, which is actually how I got into this book because I'm interested in cosmology, is how God can be known by way of contemplating the ordered beauty of the cosmos, of God's creation. But this is where I'm interested today, in this second part, chapters 30 to 34, which deal with the path of the soul, or how God can be accessed, if you like, reached by looking inwards rather than borrowing from speculative thinking of others. It's very interesting, you know. Athanasius isn't credited with too originally thinking, but at least this bit, chapters 30 to 34, you know, place him in a very interesting tradition that led to the discovery in the European culture of our interiority, of the human psyche, if you like. This tradition is exemplified briefly and brilliantly by Socrates. You know, Socrates demolished all the dogmas. Why would you go to take for granted everything? Why don't you look inside, within yourself, and find the truth that is present there? I don't discuss now the validity of the method. I'm just pointing out the fact that there's a tradition that, at least to my knowledge, started with Socrates. Then the interest in human interiority was illustrated by Plotinus, another Alexandrian in early 3rd century, the founder of Neoplatonism. Saint Athanasius seems to be among the first Christians to pay attention to this aspect, the fact that within us there is a truth that can be found, a theological truth, if you like. And of course, who launched this quest for the inner theology of the human being, if you like, is Saint Augustine in early 5th century. You know from his early dialogue, for instance, the Soliloquia or his Confessions, he speaks about interiority and how looking inwards one finds God as being more interior than my own self. So this is where we should place this group of chapters. And from a certain viewpoint, I believe that Saint Athanasius could be considered a precursor of Saint Augustine, as it is well established. Saint Augustine paid a lot of attention. He was very much interested in some of the works of the Greeks. I'm not certain as to what extent there are signs of his interest in Saint Athanasius, but something must be there. Anyway, that's a very interesting tradition, a very important tradition. You know, looking inwards in order to find God, rather than allowing the cultural context to corrupt yourself. Yeah. Anyway, the established view is that this group of chapters, 30 to 34, is about the soul's natural capacity to reach out to God by way of dreaming, which is, of course, something that was a widespread understanding in antiquity and in many pagan milieus. Kevin's chapter in the same book deals with Bishop Synesius. How is Synesius? That's your pronunciation. Yeah. Why not? No. It's Greeker than mine, anyway. a bishop in Libya, is that? Yeah. Nowadays, Libya.
Sorry. Libya. Yeah.
Nowadays, Libya, and. And also a Neoplatonist, and Synesius was far more interested in this natural capacity of dreams to put one in touch with God. That's not the case with Saint Athanasius, and I'm swimming against the tide now. You see a string of names there, scholars. I organize them chronologically. So when this idea cropped up in scholarship in 46 with Camlo, and then Marion and others, Cox Miller, the most prominent proponent of this view, namely that through dreaming, natural dreams, that is, people can meet God. What I propose is that this group of chapters barely speak of dreaming or natural dreaming, if they mention dreaming at all. I suspect that there's one place in the whole group of chapters where dreams or natural dreams may be understood, but there's nothing clear about it. Which is actually funny. Where did they get it? All these scholars, where did they get it? You know, and you know where did they get it? In the Nicene, post-Nicene fathers, you know, the famous 19th century collection, the editor of the Athanasian Corpus, well, the translator actually, Archibald Robertson, included an editorial subtitle to one of the chapters, where it's about dreaming, and everyone got it from there. But the words, or the terminology, the classical terminology for dreaming in Athanasius' Greek, is completely absent from the entire work. So, okay. That's how tradition is born in modern scholarship. Yeah. Instead, this group of chapters begin by speaking of introspection, that particular philosophical exercise, if you like, spiritual exercise, exemplified by the thinking, the approach of Socrates, Plotinus, yeah, looking inwards in order to establish the truth. Yeah, forget about your education, forget about your culture, forget about your knowledge. Try to test the ground personally. Very interesting stuff. Yeah. A very interesting aspect which is missed by all the scholars that have addressed this group of chapters. This line here, knowing God through introspection is theologically and ethically conditioned. No one points out the fact that it's not just a natural ability which can be trained through education and under the guidance of I don't know what teachers. Yeah. One can know God only when one is enriched by grace, faith, and has a pure life, an attainment that is impossible without the path of virtue. And that's the other phrase that is present in a veiled way in this group of chapters, but also in parallel texts, the path of the soul, paralleled by the path of virtue. And my firm conviction is, now that I'm about to do the final revision of my text and send it out to the world to burn at the stake and so on and so forth, is that this text focuses on what contemporary cognitive sciences call lucid dreaming, remote vision, and ecstatic experiences. Or visionary experiences. This is something very important. Again, placing Saint Athanasius in a certain tradition as a precursor again of Saint Augustine in literature. You see that the first Christian theologian to have ever recorded what contemporary cognitive sciences call lucid dreaming, it's Saint Athanasius, and he did that in a letter to some friend. What's a lucid dreaming? It's when you are somehow in control. You are dreaming, you are asleep, you're dreaming. But all of a sudden, you are aware of the fact that you are dreaming, and therefore you play the game the way you like. It's no longer your subconscious that plays you. Very interesting stuff. What I want to propose is the fact that this kind of experience, remote vision, lucid dreaming, ecstatic experiences, do not refer to natural dreaming or normal dreaming or even normal people. It refers to the saints. And although Saint Athanasius doesn't mention the saints in this work against the Gentiles, except for the beginning, it's like the preamble, you know, you need to look at the whole treatise in the light of that reference to the life of holiness. Nowhere else he refers to saints, but my suspicion is that when he speaks of the way of the soul, or the way the soul can reach out God, he actually refers to the experiences of the saints, not people like me that can dream or not, and whose dreams matter or not. Looking at my approach, well, my broad paper, I look at this group of chapters not in isolation the way Patricia Cox Miller has done, but within the treatise, and also within the Athanasian corpus, particularly taking into consideration striking parallels to this group of chapters in Life of St. Anthony and a letter which is lesser known on sickness and health, but which is a very interesting, dense, short, treatise about health, physical, moral, spiritual. And towards the end of this short letter, Saint Athanasius actually refers to this kind of extrasensory perceptions that the saints have. And that's a text that almost matches word for word what we have in Against the Gentiles. Again, a parallel that is usually not drawn between the two texts. Why? My approach takes in consideration the ascetic tradition of 4th century Egypt, particularly the monastic milieus, and I have managed to establish that this group of chapters in Against the Gentiles cannot be considered outside this tradition. And for instance, the letters of Antony, the saints of the Desert Fathers, and also the various lives of Saint Pachomius, the founder of Cenobitic life. There's no time to insist on this approach further. And from modern scholarly approaches in religious studies, I have found very helpful information in relation to soul travel, and what that's in a famous encyclopedia article by Courcelle. That's a widespread phenomenon in the landscape of humankind's religions. You know, the idea of the soul able to undertake ecstatic trips, visionary travels, these are now so well documented, including in scholarship, that it's a phenomenon that can no longer be ignored, can no longer be denied, as it happened in all the scholarship. For instance, in the 80s, the second scholar mentioned there, Culiano, he tried to dismantle the idea of ecstatic visionarism by drawing some parallels to some shamanic customs in traditional societies. You know, they would ingest this or that food or drinks or some drugs, and there you go. How's the soul able to fly away? But he actually returned to his initial views and presented a more, I think, scholarly sound and based on evidence, information or view that there are things that cannot be simply explained by some chemical reaction. And actually he wrote a booklet, Psychomodia, that's actually the name of the book, which is a composite word, psyche, soul, anno, it's an adverb pointing out upwards, odd, or those way, travel, journey, road, path. Yeah. So the ascending path of the soul. And so there's interesting literature out there, and more recently in cognitive sciences, there are so many experiences that are documented in relation to extrasensory perception and so on and so forth. And of course, it depends on the convictions or the bias of the authors or the researchers. You know, some may be very atheist and materialistic, and they explain everything by neuronal activity and so on and so forth. Others are more flexible than that. As you know, in neurosciences, there are actually two kind of schools, and the so-called mind and body issue, you know. Some reduce everything to the brain, and so there are others, other scientists who would discuss about the mind as being distinct from the brain, yeah, from the body. Anyway, no point in burdening further. And let's look at some texts. I have selected three texts. Of course, there's no time to do any in-depth analysis. There you go, the first one from chapter 30. Let no one deceive oneself in a simplistic fashion that there is no such a path leading to God, since it is for all confirmed and present, although not all walk on it. So introspection, yeah, it's something that it is at hand, but not everyone does that. You know, if you remember the beautiful history, allegory, whatever you want to call it, you know, with God's revelation on Sinai, you know, in the time of Moses, there were many people that could not even touch the mountain, let alone start to climb up the mountain. Why? Because according to traditional interpreters, they were their thinking was muddy. They could not even look inwards to find the soul. Yeah. Anyway, so not many people walk on the path of the soul. And if anyone would wonder what it is, I say that it is the soul of each one of them and the mind which is in it. Only by this mindful soul could God be gazed upon and perceived. And towards the end of this group of chapters, in chapter 34, he actually shows how is that possible, how introspection can become, instead of an inward, or it begins as an inward path, but it becomes an upwards path, you know, the ascension of the soul through contemplation. But again, what makes that possible is only when the soul is washed clean, is purified. There is, of course, the theological dimension, being made in the image of God, created in the image of God, yeah. But in order for the soul to be able to find God inwards, or through introspection, the soul should undertake purification, which means the path of virtue. But I'm not interested in these particular passages. There's here in this slide, you know, two brief lines, passages that that show how the path of the soul is supposed to be walked. See this one, faith, the kingdom of God. And the kingdom of God is, for Athanasius, an equivalent for grace. So without faith and grace, there's no way for the soul to discover God through introspection or otherwise. And the entire treatise, from beginning to end, entire against the Gentiles, is about the priority of faith and grace in order to discover God. So there's this idea, you know, that nature is corrupted by the fall, and therefore, irrespective of how well we have been designed by God, we are unable to walk the path of the soul, because that path is now muddy, clouded, there are obstacles, and these obstacles are all interior obstacles, our passions, our vices, and so on and so forth. So, and this leads to the second one, you know, where the mind encounters saints and angels only due to the purity, its purity. So asceticism, purification, virtue. And without these, no one can reach God. And these are the most significant passages that are dramatically misinterpreted by the scholars that I mentioned there in terms of dreaming. First one, chapter 31. Those are lines I included there from the edition of Thompson in the 80s. The human being often pictures mentally and contemplates things in heavens even when the body lies on the ground. Likewise, frequently the human being moves inwardly when the body rests, is quiet, and lies down to sleep. It is then that it scans things outside itself, traveling and walking about to other places and to all acquaintances. Often again, from these it surmises and forecasts the daily matters. What else could make this possible if not the rational soul by which the human being reasons and thinks about things above itself? So this passage is about proving that the soul is real. Yeah. That's the objective. That's the intention of Saint Athanasius. The soul is real. And he tries to prove that by pointing out that the fact that there is an activity of the soul or the mind or the mindful soul, he alternates the terms, even when the body is asleep. But he doesn't speak of one kind of activity. The first line, human being often pictures mentally and contemplates things in heavens, even when the body lies on the ground. So the body lies on the ground, that can be rest or can be sleep. But there's nothing clear here. It can be simply rest, you know, but you don't have to sleep in order to get some rest, you know. Or you can be asleep. But I believe that he doesn't speak here of a nocturnal event. Why? Because, first of all, he refers to imagination. The human being pictures mentally and contemplates things in heavens. Yeah? Imagination. I try to imagine, you know, daydreaming. Yeah? More like it. You know, I imagine the heavens, you know. People those days were not interested as we are in making money and, you know, I forgot to feed my cat before leaving, and so on and so forth. Their entertainment was mainly focused on the heavenly. Yeah, well, you know this. They were religious people. They would make a lot of room for religion and spirituality in their lives. So entertainment for them was very different. No wonder that even in popular novels and stories and so on and so forth, you know, the spiritual world was very present throughout late antiquity and the Middle Ages. Yeah? So, is this dreaming? I think it's the faculty of imagination, you know. I lay down, I look up, gaze at the stars or something, you know, and I close my eyes and I start thinking of myself as, Captain Picard or one of them, you know, Star Trekking the galaxy. That's imagination. But because they didn't have Star Trek at the time, they were thinking of heavens, angels, and all that, yeah? Then, frequently the human being moves inwardly when the body rests, is quiet, okay? So what's that inward movement? He gives a couple of hints. Scans things outside itself, traveling and walking about to other places. So this may be a reference to dreaming, but not the scanning thing, you know? The scanning thing is more like remote vision. And I don't have time to look at a parallel passage in that letter I told you about on sickness and health. It's word for word. Only there, it's an experience that is attributed to two saints, Daniel in the Old Testament and Elisha. No, not Elijah, the other one, the disciple, Elisha. Elisha, yeah, the disciple of Elijah. Yeah. And he gives two examples taken from the Old Testament of remote vision. Yeah? So this scanning things could be remote vision. I don't know. Do I overstep? Do I exaggerate? But that's how I read it. This one, traveling and walking about to other places and to all acquaintances, this can be a reference to dreaming. Yeah? But this is the only thing in the whole group of chapters that may signify dreaming. May. In my article, I show that it's not that clear. What's interesting, however, is inwards motions of the soul, they refer to, or they can be used in order to surmise and forecast things pertaining to everyday life. it's not about knowing God. So I had the dream, you know, and if I'm a superstitious person, you know, had a dream and friends, I had a bad dream, I won't be going out today, take day off because, God forbid, something may happen, you know. That's surmising things of everyday life from dreaming, you know. And many people are led by dreams in their decisions. Earlier this year, I spent some time in Durham, and I met there an anthropologist whose area of specialization is dreaming in contemporary jihadi movements. I had no idea whatsoever that these people wake up in the morning, go to see their boss, tell the boss their dreams, and the boss divines what to do. And that's a serious matter. Yeah. So, surmising things of everyday life, well, it depends on what people. So it's quantitative data that has been accumulated and analyzed. I mean, there are people, scholars, that make their living out of studying this phenomenon and how dreams can lead people's lives. And it's something that happens in our day and age. Yeah, but as I said, even my background, you know, in Romania, in villages and that, people are really led by dreams. Yeah, so it depends on the culture or whatever. The other passage that I want to present is from chapter 33. When the body lies down in bed, unmoved as though sleeping unto death, I tried to translate it a bit like a rhyme, because this is how it sounds in Greek. Often the soul remains awake on its own, passing above and beyond the nature of the body. And so, seemingly traveling away from the body yet remaining within it, the soul pictures mentally and contemplates unearthly realities. Many times it encounters saints who are out of their earthly bodies and angels, conversing with them without fear due to the purity of its mind. Well, this is another sample of dreaming, according to Patricia Cox-Miller. For me, the various parallels within the Athanasian corpus and outside the Athanasian corpus point somewhere else. This is not about regular dreaming. This is about the way the mind of a saint works, the way the mind of a saint functions. Although the Neoplatonists already had the idea that the soul never sleeps, you know, so sleeping for them was a bodily phenomenon that didn't touch the soul. I believe that St. Athanasius did more here than to simply reiterate that Neoplatonic tradition. Why? Because elsewhere in Life of St. Anthony and also in his tiny letter on sickness and health, there are very similar passages that ascribe this experience to the saints, purified people, full of grace, inhabited by God, and so on and so forth. In other words, what we have here are more like ecstatic experiences, visionary travels, soul travel, if you like, rather than normal dreaming. Okay, so to wrap up my view of these chapters, this group of chapters 30 to 34 in Against the Gentiles is about how God can be known through walking on the path of the soul, but only when we are equipped with faith, grace, and purification, or the acquisition of virtue. Walking the path to divine knowledge refers to introspection, vision, and contemplation. It's not normal dreaming. The only reference to natural dreams, that's the case, mentions the surmising of wisdom for everyday life, not divine knowledge. That's pretty much my analysis of of this group of chapters. Thank you.
Thank you. Attention.